the show. Hey, y'all. I am filling in for Lisa Anderson, who has the flu.
101.5.
You know, obviously she's in some unrepentant sin that she would get sick like that.
Well, what did her tweet say just a couple of minutes ago? That she realized there are reasons people get the vaccine for the flu?
That's right, yeah. So her we're sorry, Lisa. We miss you. We wish you well. But stay with us. We have a great show for the roundtable. We are going to be talking about what makes for a great hike. Right, guys?
Right.
And what makes for a bad hike. And for the culture segment, we have Donna Freitas, who is a professor at Boston University. She is the author of Sex and the Soul. And she sits down with Lisa and talks about her research, her findings, and it's really, really interesting. And for the Q&A, Steve and Suzanne will be here answering a question from a young woman who has been seeing a guy for 3 years and still doesn't know whether or not she should get married, stay together, all that. And the featured musical artist this week is Silent Substitute. Their album is Do Make Room, and I heard it, and I really liked it. So it's great having them here. So let's just go ahead and jump in with a roundtable about hiking. I am not a hiker, but I have two avid hikers here with us, Steve and Suzanne. I'm sorry.
Please, not me.
Steve and Ashley, and one not-so-avid hiker, Suzanne.
I would describe myself as an indoor girl.
Indoor girl. But you have hiking stories, right?
I do, yes.
All right. And we're going to be talking about what makes a great hike. So let's start with the avid hikers. Ashley, what makes for a great hike?
Well, I think what makes for a great hike is the company you're with. I enjoy hiking alone a little bit, but not for a long time. If I'm going to go on a long day hike, I really want to be with people that I enjoy talking to. Because unless you're on a really, really steep trail like the incline here in the Springs, then you're going to do a lot of hiking when you're talking when you're hiking. And so I think it's important that you have good conversation partners in the hike.
I wouldn't describe myself as an avid hiker, especially because with young kids, it's just hard to really go out and push an extreme hike. I haven't developed enough of a drill sergeant personality to push my kids too much further. And mm-hmm. So we end up doing some pretty modest hikes. But I like a hike where you feel like you're getting out in God's nature and in an area that's just not as neatly structured as suburban life, where you know everything's so organized and man-made, but mm-hmm. you're getting away and enjoying how God lays things out, which often are you know a lot more rough, and it gives you fresh perspective going back into life. So any hike that really pushes you out of your comfort zone a little bit and pushes you to different perspectives, and especially when you get to summit a peak or something that gives you a great vista. Mm-hmm. And so we're really blessed here in Colorado to have hikes that do that. I know though other places I've hiked in North Carolina and other things, you don't always get, you know, a mountain type experience, but just getting out in the woods or getting by water. I especially love any hike that's by a running stream where you get the kind of the soundtrack of the hike. Yeah. Is this bubbling brook or whatever. That's always nice.
Well, you know, Steve, one of the, I guess, the details of hiking out in the wilderness, being in God's country, is that the topic of a privy or the bathroom, you know, the outhouse. Being on a real hike, like you said, being out away from all things domesticated, I want to be on a trail where there's not restrooms.
Oh,
I
mean, interesting.
If I'm going to be out in nature, I want to feel like I'm out in nature.
Well, I know guys are a lot more comfortable with that.
Yeah. I know all the women are probably thinking, who are you? But there's something about being on a trail where you know there's not going to be a rest stop somewhere on the way. You really are out in the wilderness.
Yeah.
I like that. When I first started hiking, which wasn't too long ago, I remember being really shocked when I found out that there wasn't a restroom, you know, every couple miles, and thinking, there is no way I'm going to go on the side of the trail.
You know, it's funny, too. The hikes I've always looked back and enjoyed the most were the ones where we got lost and ended up off the trail and had the excitement of trying to find our way back. In fact, now when my oldest son and I go on hikes where we have gotten lost before, mm-hmm. he'll specifically say, can we go off the trail again? Because he really enjoyed that wandering around, mm-hmm. not really having a trail and having the peril of wondering if you're going to find your way back. And in some ways, it reminds me when I was little and we had this massive forest across the road from our house. And we got out playing in the woods and it was getting dark and getting late. And we realized we needed to start heading home. And as it's getting darker, we're running, trying to get back home, but not sure if we're running in the right direction. And you're so eager to get home, and you know you got to go fast, but you realize you could be going fast in the wrong direction. And there is an appreciation for finally finding your home again and kind of getting back to the normal world when you really have been pushed to that point of just wondering if you're going to make it at all. And there's so many ways you can experience that on a good hike in terms of really pushing yourself beyond your limitations, or, you know, just really getting way out there, that you have a totally different perspective for getting back into the kind of the normal world. And I think that's part of what I've always enjoyed the most.
Okay, Suzanne, what is a non-hiker's perspective on hiking?
Well, I grew up in the Northwest. And in my town, we received 100 inches of rain a year, about. I'm not exaggerating. So we were near a rainforest, if you knew there was a rainforest in Washington State. There is. And so, but my dad is a very avid hiker. And so we would still go on hikes as a family. And his favorite hike happened to be one that would ascend 8,000 feet in 4 miles. So it was basically a switchback hike. Wow. The whole entire way. And I took that hike the first time. It's called Colonel Bob for any Washingtonians who want a challenge. It's got a beautiful view of the Olympic Mountain Range and Lake Quinault. It's beautiful, but it's a very hard hike. And the first time I took it was the day before my 16th birthday, and I couldn't walk on my 16th birthday. It was really sad. I was sitting in a chair all day. So I still have some good memories from that experience. But when I came out to Colorado, the interesting thing was everyone hikes. And I know everyone out there is interested in dating and relationships. So I'm not going to lie. I have faked it that I'm a hiker to go out on a date. Because that will be a common, like, hey, do you love to hike? Like, we should go hiking. And actually, with Kevin, who's my fiance, one of our first dates was hiking in Palmer Park. And it was... We got there probably 30 minutes before dusk, and so we were walking and hiking, and it became a trust experiment.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't sure he knew where he was going, and it was getting darker and darker, and I'm not a very good hiker, and I was getting a little scared but trying to act not scared, and we got back to the car just at the right moment.
But. Yeah.
You know, so. I was a fake hiker, too.
Nice!
That was mine and Beth's first date, too, was a hike at Great Falls in Northern Virginia. And it's one of the few hikes I've ever been on in my life. But it's interesting you talk about your dad and how he took you hiking. I came from a family of non-hikers. And we lived in South Carolina. I grew up in South Carolina. And there were a lot of thick woods around our house. So we would traipse through the woods. I mean, my entire life, we would go on adventures in the woods. But I wouldn't call that hiking. And so I didn't grow up a hiker. And I'm still not a hiker. I think I would, you know, I'd rather spend my time with a cup of coffee and reading the Wall Street Journal or something. I just can't. I guess I don't have that sense of adventure. Although I do like camping, it seems like those should go together a little bit. And like you, Ashley, I like going to the remote places. If I'm going to go camping, I don't want to go to a place where you see a bunch of campers and you just pull up and they have hookups and they have showers and bathrooms. I want to go somewhere that's very remote, by, you know, at the top of a mountain or near a stream, or maybe even do some fishing.
A destination hike.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so. You can go get somewhere cool and spend some time there.
I think so.
You know, Candace and I realized too that we have a different approach to hiking than some friends we went with on a hike who really love to just keep this very quick pace, very aggressive, quickly wind you and just keep moving on. And we're the type to like to stop and enjoy some scenery along the way. Anybody who, especially here in Colorado, we've got just so many incredible places to just stop and enjoy the view. And when you're hiking with someone who just has this idea of, you know, I need to stay at this quick clip and stay as breathless as possible, I found myself saying, so what's the point? Is it just to wear yourself out, or are you going to enjoy, you know, all God's handiwork here?
Yeah.
And so I think that's our personality about hiking.
I think I sensed that a little bit on an email thread with Candace this week, because I hiked Pikes Peak on Sunday, and she emailed me on Monday and said, oh, did you get pictures? I was like, no way. We're going to pack in a camera? That's extra weight. We took a picture at the top, you know? And I could just tell she was really dumbfounded.
You know, that's a good point. If we had tried to do that same hike, it would have taken us 5 days because of all the pictures Candace would have stopped to take.
Well, what about gear? I mean, what kind of gear do you need? I know that's always prohibitive for me going hiking when I'm invited to go hike. I'm like, I don't have any hiking shoes. I don't have a backpack, really.
I feel strongly about gear. And I think one of the most important things is clothing. Because I'm not going to wear any form of cotton if I'm doing a lengthy hike. I didn't wear a single piece of cotton on Sunday. Everything from my socks to my hat was synthetic or wool because it wicks. And when we got to the top of the mountain, I looked around at the group I was with, and they all had, you know, sweat stains on their back from their shirts because they were wearing cotton. And I was as dry as could be because I was in synthetic clothing from head to toe. And so it's already going to be sweaty. We hiked through 2 miles of snow, so we were pretty wet by the time we got there. But I think I was probably more dry than the rest of the group. So that's one thing that I think is important. If you're going to get into hiking, make an investment in a pair of, you know, $6 synthetic or wool socks. Buy a cheap synthetic shirt from Target because, you know, as they say, cotton kills.
Well, the same thing with shoes. We've done some what we thought were going to be casual hikes, so that we did it spontaneously and went out in our sandals or flip-flops or whatever. And you quickly realize the value of having the right shoes on, especially when you need sure footing and you realize your sandals aren't working with you here, and you'd be much better off with something that's got the grip and was made for that kind of terrain.
And Steve has a fanny pack that he wears.
Ain't got no essential fanny pack. Now, I will say, though, I've done a lot of hikes with the kids on a backpack. And that's a good workout. In fact, I mean, you come back from the hike and you take that thing off and you feel like you're going to dive forward because you've been adjusting your weight and trying to accommodate them. It definitely has made it much more of a workout. But that was one of those cases where one hike I had the wrong shoes and ended up slipping in this one place, and the backpack came down to where Zoe, who was in the backpack at the time, ended up kind of brushing her head against a fence post or something and wailing the whole rest of the hike. And I realized, okay, I got to have the right shoes and do this right, or the kid's going to get hurt here.
Yeah. Another thing about gear is your pack. And I think that depends on what kind of hiking you're going to do. If you're going to do a short day hike, then you don't need anything more than a small backpack or camelback. But even doing a day hike, I would say you need a pack with the strap around the waist and around the chest that gives you good support. And if you're a female, buy a small camelback and let the guy you're with, carry the big backpack and all the stuff. Because the smaller pack you carry, the less stuff you have to take. It's just an insider tip right there. That's what I did on Sunday.
Wow.
But if you're going to be out longer than a day, if you're going to be backpacking, then I would say make a good investment in the pack that you buy. I've been backpacking 2 summers in northern Maine, and I've made a little bit of an investment in a backpack, and I'm really glad I did, because when you have something that weighs 50 pounds on your back for more than a day, it matters how comfortable it is. It matters what the pockets are like. You want access on the outside for reaching for your water bottle or your rain gear. You want those things accessible. And if you have a pack that is mostly carrying your gear on the inside, it's going to get old after a while.
Well, thanks, guys. I think that's more than I ever wanted to know about hiking. It was good.
Well, maybe next time we'll actually bring in some professional guides or somebody who can really push it to the next level. I'm sure we disappointed the overly avid hikers.
Well, speaking of that, I was wondering about safety. Mm-hmm. I mean, what are the top things if you're not an avid hiker and you're wanting to get started, what should you remember as far as safety on the trail?
Band-aids.
Well, on a serious note, as far as Band-Aids, moleskin or duct tape, something for your blisters. Because if you're, you know, a couple miles away from trailhead and you have some real severe blisters, that is going to make a really hard hike back. And so I always make sure that, you know, I carry moleskin or someone I'm with has duct tape that you can slap on a blister and make it back to trailhead. That's important.
Well, and you know, something else some casual hikers don't always remember is that you can get hurt worse going downhill than uphill. Mm-hmm. That when you're uphill, you're positioned in such a way that you fall a little smarter, but downhill is where some people get hurt the worst. They kind of take for granted that you can coast, and that's where you're actually a little more vulnerable.
And I would also say be realistic about your water supply and your food supply. If you don't think you have enough water, that's something I would rather have more than less, even though it's a little more weight. Because if you do get lost or you get off trail like Steve says that he does sometimes, you don't want to be stranded without enough food and water to get you back.
Well, and too, I mean, you got to watch the weather and realize that, especially some states more than others, Colorado is one of the most dangerous lightning states,
mm-hmm.
where you got to avoid those vulnerable lightning spots and be cognizant about the trails you're going to take on in consideration with the weather forecast for where you're going to be when the big storm comes.
And don't hike alone.
Right, don't hike alone.
My dad's the only hiker in our family, so he joined the Olympic Mountain Hiking Club. So if he wants to do a hike, he can meet up with other guys who are doing the same hike, and it's a safer way to go.
Oh, I read something on the news this morning about a boy in Utah. Has anyone else read this? He was a boy in Utah. He was 9 years old going into the fourth grade, and he was lost in the wilderness with his family over the weekend. For 18 hours, he was in the wilderness by himself, but he had watched enough of Survivor Man that he started tearing off pieces of his yellow raincoat. Or his, maybe it was a poncho, and he would stick it to trees as he went to signal where he was. And he would kind of leave his trail. And on Sunday, finally, when two rangers found him, they said his first words when they got back to his family was, Happy Father's Day, Dad. He wasn't worried. He said that because he had been hiking with his dad enough and he had watched enough Survivor Man, he knew what to do, and he was calm.
See, I never saw that on Survivor Man, and I've seen every episode.
Today's culture segment, I am in the studio with Donna Freitas. For those of you who don't know, Donna is the assistant professor of religion at Boston University in Boston, Mass., and she is the author of the book Sex and the Soul. And Donna was just here with us with employees this morning speaking on this topic and related to a lot of the findings she had in a series of or a stretch. She's going to talk about it a little bit of going to a number of different college campuses of all different persuasions and taking some data, talking to students about their views on sexuality and spirituality specifically. In fact, the subtitle of the book is Juggling Sexuality, Spirituality, Romance, and Religion on America's College Campuses. So welcome, Donna.
Thanks for having me.
Yay. How are you liking Colorado so far?
Oh, it's beautiful. You're
it is.
And
isn't
nice
it?
Weather.
It is, yeah. Good thing you weren't here a week or two ago, because, but just be careful because tomorrow we could have snow and 30 degrees. So just watch out for that. But, well, it's so exciting to have you here. I have heard, I have not yet read the book. I have a copy of the book, though, and have read a couple portions of it. So, and then I was there this morning as you were talking. And, Sex and the Soul. somewhat provocative title in that sense. But give us a little feel as we kick off here, just how the book came about.
Well, I've been grappling with these issues. I guess generally I started out thinking about theology in relation to dating because I didn't really find many resources or any resources that spoke to me when I was engaging in that particular part of my life. And so that's where my own interest in the topic came from. But as I began teaching at college students, I noticed that they would perk up ever so much more in the segments of my class where sexuality and spirituality began to be raised together. And then so I taught a course called Dating or Dating and Friendship that was devoted exclusively to that conversation. And what happened about midway through that semester after my students came back from spring break was on our campus, students lived in hookup culture. And so it's a very generally sexually active culture, or at least if it's not quite as sexually active as students imagine, there is the pressure to be very sexually active all the time. And of course, that's paired with drinking. But one of the students admitted after spring break that she hooked up all the time, and to be honest, she really hated it and made her unhappy. And this sent the class into a conversation about how they actually all felt that way, but they had believed that every single person in the room loved hooking up. So that's why they acted as if they loved it too. And then that made them want to change the whole campus once they found out that they all felt the same way and they had all been pretending to like something that nobody liked.
Okay. Now, I thought that was pretty fascinating because when you were talking this morning, I knew the definition of a hookup, but I didn't know the definition of a hookup culture. So kind of distinguish that, what you talked about in terms of emotional investment and how that applies, you know, broad base across a campus.
Well, I think most people, when they talk about how it's really hard to define hooking up because it seems to be anything from kissing to having different types of sex, which is something I heard over and over from the students I talked to in the study. So yes, but really what defines a hookup is not so much whatever physical intimacy happens, but that students train themselves or believe that they're supposed to train themselves to shut down emotionally so that they do not get attached to the person that they are physically intimate with. So the goal is to erase any sort of emotional interest or attachment so that a successful hookup, theoretically, is one where you literally do not care about the other person and you come away with it not caring if you ever see them or speak to them again. So you have essentially, you know, part of college and participating in hookup culture is training yourself to shut down in that way in order to become sexually active.
Okay. So students who say that they engage in this behavior kind of because it's the thing to do or it is expected, but they know they have to emotionally shut down. For them then, what is the, I guess benefit would be too strong of a word, but then why is it actually happening then? Would you, you know, because any like reason, you know, college student, even one who wants to give some semblance of making sense with this issue, you know, would want to say there's more investment in it or there should be, but obviously there's not. So why engage in the behavior?
Well, that's in many ways the million-dollar question, because when you sit down and talk to students privately, as I did with this study, what I found out was both men and women do not enjoy hooking up. So, and they have different ways of talking about why or expressing themselves about this, but nobody seems to like it. Nobody seems to want to, or nobody seems to really find it fulfilling or productive in the way of whether that's, you know, sexually fulfilling or fulfilling in terms of finding a romantic partner. They know it's not a good way to go about it. And so really, I think the question is, What is going on, or where is this pressure coming from? How is it being, you know, perpetuated, where you have, you know, young men and young women who are, you know, getting to college and then feeling, oh, this is what it means to have a great college experience. I'm supposed to love this. Mm-hmm. So even if I don't, I'm going to act like it, because that's what everybody expects of you at college. It's supposed to be the time of your life, and this is part of what the time of your life is.
Sure. So what then, I know you talk in the book quite a bit about what your actual findings were. You said you went to a number of different types of colleges. You went to Catholic universities, you went to private secular universities as well as public, and then you went to some evangelical campuses. Give us an idea of what you found.
Well, it really splits between evangelical colleges and every other college type. And so in the book, I have to sort of separate those conversations and have them stand side by side, really, so you can see the differences. But at evangelical colleges, I found that you don't have hookup culture. It's really the only place I didn't find it. When I asked students, you know, how do you define hookup? I often got, you know, well, you get together with your friends as an answer, as opposed to the other definition we talked about of hooking up. And what I found at evangelical colleges was purity culture. Mm-hmm. And, you know, basically the priority was, how can we stay as pure as possible while we're here at college? And also, there was a goal of finding a marriage partner, generally on the part of the women, not as much on the part of the men. So there was certainly pressure having to do with sex or stress having to do with sex, but it showed up in a very different way than it did at every other campus, where I found hookup culture to just be the dominant culture students were struggling with. And so whereas, you know, you can't separate faith and sex at an evangelical college, because really the students that I met, faith was at their core and every question or struggle they had really flowed out from there. At all the other colleges where you have students who are in the middle of hookup culture in some way, even if they're not actively participating in it or if they're lying about participating in it, which many students do, what you have are students who are turning to spirituality, a very more amorphous spirituality, because they associate it with meaning and because eventually there seems to be this moment when students wake up after some sort of, you know, night out and they feel empty and unsatisfied and they realize that they're not getting any fulfillment out of their sexual activities or this environment, and they begin to turn to spirituality as a way to dig out of this place, because they associate spirituality with meaning, and that meaning is absent from their sex life. So you have very different cultures, but across the board you have stress about sex.
Mm-hmm. Do you think these students, Donna, want a bigger standard for sexuality, but just don't know? Because we're going to talk about this a little bit with the evangelicals, who would have a bigger standard, whether or not they, you know, buy into it or whether or not they think it's actually realistic or whatever. They're going to say there is an objective standard. What about all these other students? How do they find that standard that then, in fact, does jive with their search for meaning and individual purpose and individual, you know, a sense of self?
I guess what I would say about students in hookup culture and where you know, or on campuses where you don't have a sort of singular compass around which the campus is centered, such as, for example, we're all here because we're Christians. Or mm-hmm. One of the things that I saw a lot of desire for, or that really sparked students, was I didn't see students interested so much in, never having sex, or suddenly, you know, deciding I will not have premarital sex, or that wasn't so much the conversation.
There wasn't a rush on purity rings.
No,
there was
definitely not that. However, okay. There was this sense of I'm not comfortable with the extreme casual nature of this space that I am in. And there was also a sense of a powerlessness to change that, or even the idea that I have a right to come up with my own boundaries on this issue that may be totally different from the rest of the campus, because what, you know, you're living in is a sea of people who feel, you know, who are essentially purveying the idea that there are no boundaries. And so there, what's clearly there is a desire for more boundaries, however those take shape. Certainly, you know, more boundaries than what they've got, which is, you know, nothing, basically, essentially. But at the same time, I think this sense of really not realizing it's okay to draw boundaries, or even to experiment with what those might be, or to give yourself space to think about it. And so part of what seems to be missing from conversations about sex on so many campuses is simply that, you know, students will certainly, they know to draw a line about sexual assault, but that's about where it stops. And so often in my conversations with students or in the classes I've taught on this topic, the eureka moment comes when they realize, oh, you mean I could just decide I'm not going to kiss people anymore. Like, I could do that. Oh, there are people who do that. Because it was almost novel to them that there were people who do that. And what's going on is that they just don't hear that there are people who do that, or they don't know that there is the possibility of boundaries beyond sexual assault, because no one's having that conversation with them. Mm. And they're not having it with each other, because they're making all sorts of assumptions that everybody on campus has this sort of no holds barred attitude about sex. So I think it's what feels really hard for these students is they know that there isn't going to be a universal standard where they are. And so the way they've taken it is that they can't have a standard at all. Mm-hmm. So I guess navigating somewhere in the middle of that, you know, in the middle of those two places, I think is where they want to go when they realize they could.
Sure. Okay. So just as we kind of wrap up here, Donna, what would you say? I'm just curious, if you brought a sampling of these kids into a room from all these different colleges, what do you think some of the big, kind of the biggest cornerstone things, issues or whatever, that what would come up and what would be the differences? I mean, do you think this would just be like crazy, like, oh my goodness, who are you? And, you know, just kind of what interactions would you expect in that? And then what, you know, just in like, if you were to sit down with them for 15 minutes, what's the one thing that you would say that you would want all of them to hear and really be able to take away from a conversation on this?
Well, to answer your first question, I would, you know, the key, of course, to being able to have an open conversation with those students is that they'd be assured total anonymity. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's a sense of you, or they would already trust each other. There has to be a great degree of trust, I think, for these students to talk openly about these issues. But I think what I hear, you know, what I heard those students talking about over and over again, and when I go do college visits now that Sex and the Soul is out and people invite me to come to campus, I have students coming on one by one, and this is what they say. They really want to have open, honest conversation about sex on campus, whether it's just because they're curious about something, because they've had an experience and they want to talk about it. And they want it to be a safe conversation, a safe and honest conversation. And for that to happen, they want those policies gone. Mm. So those policies that say I could get kicked out if I have sex, because that prevents them from being honest. They want, it's almost like letting the pressure out. They want that pressure of being, you know, presenting purity to such an extreme degree, or being dishonest with their peers, to go away. They want honest conversations about gender. They feel like that's a whole issue, especially for women. You know, I heard over and over from women, ring by spring or your money back. You know, college means for women getting a ring on your finger, and you could have straight A's, but you failed college if you don't have the ring when you graduate. And they also feel like, you know, and guys felt like, oh yeah, it's a girl's job to get a ring on her finger, but actually it's not my job to get married, you know, be engaged by the time I graduate. So there's a big difference there. Mm. But also just gender roles in general, a lot of frustration, both from men and women, I think, about, you know, guys who feel they're supposed to be sexual predators, yet they don't feel that way. They're sort of told that they are, and they actually don't feel that way. They are really nervous to ask women out, and often they wish women would ask them out. Hmm. And so you hear that, but also women who want to be able to be, you know, express sexual desires because they have them, they know they do, but they feel like they're not allowed to say that because that's not somehow what it means to be a good Christian woman. But also they feel like they have to engage in this sort of strange dance of somehow letting a guy know they like them without ever saying they like them, because they're not allowed to say they like them. Mm. Because, you know, girls aren't allowed to express themselves first to someone. So there was this a lot of frustration and anger about these gender role expectations that they feel like don't really work for who they really are.
Wow. Okay. Well,
you had a second part to that, but those are the things that come up all the time.
Oh, so. Yeah. Oh, the second part was just then, you know, you giving the chance to sit down for 15 minutes with all of these kids across the board. What's really the one thing you'd want them to take away, the communication you'd want to give to them, or either a call to action or some sense of hope in their situation?
I guess I would say that, you know, college students are great actors and actresses, and they, you know, across the board, regardless of what kind of campus you go to, students, you know, you know, they act toward whatever peer, you know, they think their peers expect, even if they feel differently. And they assume that whatever culture exists on the surface when they get to college is the one that everybody agrees with, when in reality, it seems that everybody disagrees with that culture. And so, and they all become actors and actresses participating in it. They're good at putting on their game face, when in reality, pretty much the majority of students want a whole different sort of college experience with regard to these issues. They want meaning. They want open dialogue. They want honesty. They, you know, in hookup culture, they want a lot less sex. You know, and at evangelical colleges, they want a lot more openness about sex. But what gets in the way often of them having the real experiences and conversations that they want are all these misperceptions. And so somehow figuring out how can we feel safe with our peers, and then also who can help us create that safe space on campus? How can parents help us feel empowered to be honest about what we believe in, you know, to our peers, to give us that strength? But also how can faculty, administration, campus ministers really think about how can we offer this safe space for students to begin being honest, you know, and what's a pretty unproductive peer culture that they're, you know, supporting and passing on to other students who come in as first years every year.
Yeah, that's something I was just going to ask is, you know, what is the place then, or is there even a space or a voice for adults in this, for the parents, for mentors, for leadership, for, you know, will they be listened to? And if they are going to be listened to, what, how do they need to say what they're going to say, and how do they need to model that from a student's perspective?
I think there's a huge role for, you know, all the, you know, different parties, I guess, in this conversation with students on campus, whether you're a parent or a faculty member or campus minister. And the issue, though, is realizing, first of all, that students put tremendous pressure on each other. So in terms of culture, students really do create the culture that they, you know, they live in. They support it. And so whether it's positive or negative. So realizing that, but that also there's a kind of authority in their age and their experience that we need to recognize and be willing to come to the table and discuss. But I think what parents and other constituencies on campus really can do is what I said before, providing strength and empowerment to express what you really believe openly, not what you think everybody else wants to hear, what your peers, you know, what your peers think, but what you, who you really are, because chances are you'll find out that everybody else is pretty similar to you in this regard. But really creating that space where students feel safe to be honest and open is the trickiest thing to do, because students are so scared of being different and losing everything on this issue. So how can we do this in the classroom? How can we begin to, you know, on hookup, especially in hookup culture, how can we begin to take the different skills students learn in the classroom and apply them outside the classroom, for example, to where that, you know, when they go to parties? Because something as simple as all these skills students learn in the classroom apply really well to, you know, come to life, I think, when students go to parties, but it hasn't occurred to anybody to say you should apply these. So sometimes it's as simple as that. And so I think adults willing to look at what students are really doing and facing, you know, without fear is important, but also we can give them the power and the strength to be open if we invite them to the table, or if we invite the conversation that they're so afraid to open up themselves.
Sure. Okay. Well, wow, that's quite a reality check, and quite a look, an honest look at where students are in their own experiences and in their own hearts and minds as they look at their sexuality, specifically as viewed through the lens of their experience and what they hope for themselves, looking at their futures. You know, is this really what I've got and what was expected of me on a college campus? And we can easily, you know, do another show of how this then translates into folks when they move into their 20s. And 30s, having walked through this gauntlet, whether being sexually active or not. So, but Dr. Donna Freitas has been my guest. Her book is Sex and the Soul. You can find out more about it at boundless.org. We're going to go ahead and give a shout out to it there on our website. And again, she is assistant professor of religion at Boston University there in Boston. But she was visiting us here in Colorado Springs today. And we just appreciate you being part of this conversation, Donna, and sharing what you did learn and really the outcomes of the book. It's fascinating.
Well, thanks for inviting me to participate and enjoyed it.
Return to what I so desire. What I want is what I need. Just as ignorance is bliss, cloak deception is betrayal. But I guess I'm hearing what you want to hear. The rhythm of my emotions. Hear the rhythm.
For this week's inbox are Suzanne Hadley.
Hi,
Suzanne.
Hi, Matt.
And Steve Waters.
Matt.
And this is a really interesting question, a long question, and I'm going to just paraphrase the first part of it, and then I'm going to read the last two paragraphs. It's from a young lady named Amy, and she has been together with her boyfriend for 3 years. They are in their last year of college, and she says that they are different in more ways than one, and that her boyfriend is hesitant to get married. And I'm going to pick it up here. I don't feel like I can really understand him sometimes, and he even says he doesn't think I can fully understand him. I think the fact that I can't really understand him sometimes has made it hard for him to know whether I'm the one for him. It breaks my heart. He's never wanted to marry young. He feels pressure to have an income and home first before proposing. I'm not sure whether I should stay with him, hoping he'll decide he wants to marry me in the future, or leave, hoping to meet a more compatible guy. I don't want to wait until I'm 25 before we realize we don't suit each other. I'm so lost and confused. If it's possible, I'd like to know what you would do in this situation. Suzanne?
Wow, well, I definitely related to this question, and just having observed my friends and also some of my own experiences. And in the part that you paraphrased, Mott, she did talk about them being very opposite, mm-hmm. having a hard time connecting sometimes, and this idea that her boyfriend doesn't seem ready for marriage, even though they've been together for 3 years. So from my perspective, I think that she's doing the right thing, giving this some serious consideration and making this call of, should we move forward from here? Is it wise to move forward from here? Is there enough compatibility that this is going to make it in the long term? Or is it just an issue of the guy being hesitant, which I think that Steve could probably speak to?
Yeah, it sounds like they've found something to connect about for 3 years now, and that they've got something that keeps them together in more of a casual recreational relationship. But she's asking the question, is this good enough for marriage? And there is always this thread that you're going to miss out on what you're currently enjoying if you start asking the bigger questions about, mm-hmm. is this built to last? Is this relationship a sufficient foundation for a lifelong marriage? And it sounds like she's reluctant to lose that minimal connection they do have, even if it's got some shortcomings to it. And it sounds like he is too. But what we consistently come back to on the balance show is that you're going to have to give an account one day. Were you a good steward of that time in your life? And what do they have to show for that 3 years? Have they put a lot of wear and tear on each other's heart? Have they kept themselves from being with someone who is going to be a lot more intentional and timely about deciding if that's a good relationship? Mm-hmm. And so it sounds like she needs to be willing to lose what she likes about staying together and in this recreational relationship if she really does want to be objective about marriage.
Yeah, you know, I wonder when she realized when he didn't want to marry young. I mean, it seems like they started dating when they were 18 or 19, and he says, I don't want to marry young. Well, you know, why are they dating? And, you know, how young is young? Does that mean he might be ready in 3 years and 5 years? Yeah, she needs to.
And after 3 years of dating, those compatibility issues that you're feeling should be valid. You need to take a hard look at those. And that's what I was saying with the experience that I've seen. You can't force a relationship to work. And if you have these, if it's hard to make the relationship work before you're even engaged or married, I think you should look at that seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think you need the opinion of others, the observation of others. I mean, she needs to go to maybe her parents or some mature Christians that she respects and have them look at their relationship. Does she know people who know them both and can really give her some advice knowing them both? I don't think she can do this alone.
Yeah, invite that feedback, because I know I was in a relationship that wasn't quite working, but it wasn't until after we ended it that suddenly everyone was like, oh, I noticed that, and I never thought that you guys were really that good of a match, or I always wondered if that was going to work out. And I was thinking, why didn't you tell me?
Yeah.
You know, but people don't want to step on toes, so it's good to actually ask the people who are close to you what they think.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, there is the issue of being willing to let go of what she might see as a bird in the hand, that she's thinking, well, it's not all that I'm looking for, but at least it's something.
Mm-hmm.
And should I be willing to have nothing in my desire for something later? And obviously, no relationship is going to meet all of your expectations, and you're always going to have reasons for reservation. But if after 3 years, you're still having some pretty major reservations, but what's keeping you together is the sense of, well, I don't want to go to nothing. I still like having something.
Yeah,
Realize that's ultimately going to cannibalize your ability to have a great long-term relationship.
Yeah, she shouldn't set an age. I mean, like 23. She says she wants to be married by 23 as the reason to either stay with this guy or to move on. She's, you know, it sounds like she's putting an age out there as this expectation for herself to be married. I don't know that that's healthy.
Yeah, you can't have a magic age mentality. I think that was part of what was driving a bad engagement that I ended up in, was this sense of, boy, I thought I'd be married by now, and I thought I would have married someone from the college I attended, and therefore, you know, maybe I should force this relationship that kind of meets those criteria. That we can easily get tripped up on magic age thinking. But there is something to be said for, especially a 3-year relationship, that relationship is going to be vulnerable to sexual temptations. Mm-hmm. And the longer it goes without seriously dealing with the marriage question, you're only going to be more vulnerable to sexual temptation. And you're going to find yourself in a position where the relationship glue is the physical connection, not necessarily a real thriving compatibility.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, guys. I hope that's helpful for Amy and for anybody who's in a relationship that seems to be going on in years and seems to be going nowhere. If you are, let us know. Let us hear about it. Write to us at editor@boundless.org. And thanks for joining us this week.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org, focused on the family.